And I just looked at the time. I didn't realize that I actually went on, Kevin and I went on a bit of a rant there for a little while. So I've unfortunately had poor Jim Harris sitting on the phone waiting for us. Are you still there, Jim?
I'm here.
Thank you so much for your patience. I'm sorry we got a little bit carried away there for a minute.
No problem. I understand completely.
Just a lot of strong emotions today. It's an absolute pleasure to get you on the program. We spoke a while ago, and I was really we had a really great talk when I talked to you on the phone before. So I was hoping we could get you on. So people have been listening to me talk for almost 20 minutes now. Maybe you'd be so kind as to introduce yourself.
Well, I'm the former leader of the Green Party of Canada, and a passionate environmentalist.
And you've done quite a bit of public speaking. You've put out a couple of books as well. We have here in front of me, there's a Blindsided was one. Crisis is a Terrible Thing to Waste was another. What are you doing these days since you're no longer involved with the Green Party?
Well, I still am involved with the Green Party in the sense that I'm a member and a donor, and I'm working to support Mike Schreiner's bid to win the first Green seat in Ontario. He's running in Guelph, and he's got a great chance to win that seat. In 2008, the party was tied for first place in the federal by-election in the last week of the election, and then the day before we went to the polls, Harper canceled that by-election and turned it into a general. So I know it's a winnable riding, and Mike has a great shot. So I'm still involved with the party, but just not doing the really intense work that I did for 8 years as the leader of the Green Party of Canada and the national campaign chair.
You're still very much involved with sort of being a people person professionally, almost it was. I don't know if that was too many P's in a sentence, but one of the things that I immediately noticed after our brief conversation a little while ago getting organized for this interview was that you're very much like to sort of draw from your personal experience and make examples out of that. And I know some of the stuff that you've been doing have been consulting with, doing things like consulting with businesses and trying to help them encourage a sustainable way of thinking. Is that how you would put it?
Yeah, very much. Going green has huge benefits financially, cutting costs, raising revenue, and mitigating risks. So, for instance, just in a single year, by focusing on energy efficiency of its trucking fleet, Walmart was able to save $200 million. Because they drive 1 billion miles a year and have the second largest fleet of trucks in the U.S. So simply putting a skirt on the truck, and a skirt is a metal cladding that goes down from the truck to just above the pavement, but it cuts down airflow, churn of air, and increases fuel efficiency by 6%. So when you're doing 1 billion miles a year, a 6% improvement in fuel efficiency has huge economic benefits. So cutting costs, it's all about becoming more efficient. So you don't even have to talk about green. It makes business sense to be efficient and eliminate waste.
And so you gave, I think, a really good example there of say, like a bigger company. People, I think a lot of time will hear about, Walmart trying to be sustainable, and a lot of people will roll their eyes. And I think that particular company, just to pick on them for a second, has definitely been guilty of some greenwashing to some extent. I've seen reports about them. But as you're saying, a lot of the time, this isn't about necessarily going out and convincing them to redevelop every single one of their products, but simply about like, well, here's some places where you have a massive footprint, and Walmart has one of the largest truck fleets. You were saying, and just something that will save them money also happens to be good for the environment. Have you found a lot of traction with this argument as far as like, have you found it easy to convince people that this is actually the case, or do people tend to be resistant?
Well, people really don't realize how much efficiency we can wring out of the system. Sears, for instance, a year or 2 years ago, retrofitted 130,000 incandescent light bulbs that were retail displays to accent them. They changed them to LEDs. It was a $4.5 million project that had a 13-month payback. Now, show me where in a recessionary market, if you were to invest $4.5 million, you'd get that $4.5 million back every year from now to eternity. And are you going to try and tell me that that's not the best thing since sliced bread for a business person?
Mm.
So we have a lot of false information, in part because of, I was listening to the prior discussion involving the Harper government. When John Baird was Minister of the Environment, he said before a Senate committee that meeting our Kyoto goals would manufacture the worst recession since the Great Depression. And in fact, nothing can be further from the truth. Companies like McKinsey have shown that there's a couple $1 trillion of energy efficiency initiatives that are highly profitable, available worldwide, but aren't being taken advantage of right now. So imagine $2 trillion of investment that would have a positive payback that isn't being done. So we've been sold a false, we've been lied to, that going green is expensive or would bankrupt you, when in fact the opposite is true.
Hi, Jim. This is Kevin. We've actually met. I was one of your candidates in the 2006 general election for the riding of St. Paul's in Toronto.
Always good to get that bias on record. Good. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's good for full disclosure. We've met. There's no way you would remember me, though. I'm interested in the strategy you're taking with motivating businesses to become green. And I'm wondering about the distinction between making a few green advancements and actually becoming a sustainable industry along the lines of what Ray Anderson did with Interface in the United States. And I'm wondering, are you pushing businesses to become sustainable, or are you just trying to, you know, sort of make some cost-efficient green adjustments to their business model?
Well, first off, Ray Anderson, before he died, would not have said that Interface was sustainable yet.
Now, no, but he had a plan to achieve 100% sustainability.
Yeah, they wanted to get to be a restorative company, in other words, where they absorb more carbon and toxins than they produce. So they're a net negative, so they're an absorber of these things. So not even Interface is sustainable yet. So we can't say there are any sustainable companies. So the goal is to make all companies more sustainable. And there's no way that Walmart's sustainable if Interface isn't sustainable. In fact, with Walmart, they end up on the list for companies that are the best in terms of doing making change. And they also consistently end up on the list for the worst. So it's paradoxical. And trucking isn't the solution, really. It's intermodal transportation, because transport by rail cuts the carbon footprint by 85% compared to trucking. So you can make your trucks more efficient. You can save $200 million, but trucks aren't the way to go. So it's more sustainable. But when you have to look at the overall picture and say, hey, we actually have to move to intermodal, and the trucks are used for that last mile of transport.
One of the things I'd be really interested to hear your perspective on, and it would be normally the sort of thing where I would have maybe done an entire interview just on this topic, except that it's something that for me that I've been going to a lot of conferences and stuff recently, and I've met with quite a number of students here at the University of Toronto recently, and it's an issue that's just come up again and again and again. So I wondered if maybe I could put you on the spot a little bit and just get your two cents on that. A lot of people that I'm hearing is reaction to, like, for instance, when we're talking about, like, we'll continue using Walmart as the example, but they're of course by no means the only company that has a large global impact. But when we're talking about, like, for instance, well, you know, improving the trucks, or, you know, increasing general overall sustainability, at the end of the day, there's still a company that sells things. And what a lot of people's concern is that it's not that we should be consuming all these products and then trying to make them as green, as less toxic as possible, as carbon neutral as possible. But increasingly, I'm hearing that a lot of people are just sort of fed up with the idea of consumerist culture, and that the answer isn't to have a greener product. It's, do we even need that product?
Yes, that's another wider discussion, which is, we are consuming globally 1.5 times what the Earth can produce. In other words, we're attacking the capital. We're not living off the interest.
Mm-hmm.
Or to put it another way, you know, given our in North America, we represent 5% of the world's population, but we consume 33% of the world's resources. So clearly, that is not sustainable, and we need to change that dramatically. But we live in this culture, and we need to celebrate our successes and create a momentum moving towards where we need to go.
Mm-hmm.
I, for instance, bought a Prius 8 years ago, and it cost me $4,000 more than a car, the equivalent car would have been that wasn't a hybrid. But over the last 8 years, I've saved $18,000 with it in reduced fuel use. And over the next 8 years, I'll save another at least $18,000, meaning I will have saved the entire capital cost in the car over the time frame that I've used it. So if we want to change society, we need to show people how it's beneficial for them. I'll just give you an example. A lot of environmentalists like to use guilt or negative framing as the way to drive change. And so as, you know, Greens, for instance, I was always concerned about the billions of plastic bags that went into landfill. So I campaigned for many years for cloth and string bags and so on. Well, we got to about 7% of the population doing this. Why? Because if I wanted to do the right thing 5 years ago, I had to buy a bag for $3. And every time I took it to the grocery store, I avoided double bagging. So at 3 cents a plastic bag, every week I saved that grocery store 6 cents. And over a year, I saved them $3. They got $3 of profit for my doing the right thing, and I paid $3. And then as environmentalists, we wonder why more people aren't doing it, because we're asking people to financially punish themselves. So we're financially punishing the right behavior, and we're financially rewarding those who are engaged in the wrong behavior. So the City of Toronto passed a bylaw that said you had to pay 5 cents a plastic bag. And you know, in 1 month, plastic bag use fell 70%. Well, why? Two reasons. One, there was such a demand for cloth bags that instead of $3 a bag, it went to 99 cents at most places. So as a consumer, I'd look at this cloth bag and say, hey, I can buy it for a buck. And if I use it because you put the double bag stuff in there for 10 weeks, I've earned back my money. So we sold in Toronto millions of cloth bags in the first month or two after that bylaw went in. And so all of a sudden we're rewarding people. They're getting a financial benefit for doing the right thing. So what we have to do as environmentalists is say, look, 30 years of working to change plastic bag use using guilt and negative framing got us 7% of the population. But once we had a marginal change in the economics, like 5 cents a bag is nothing if you're spending $200-$300 a week as a normal family on groceries. 5 cents a bag is nothing. This tiny little economic change had a 70% change in the market in 30 days. So 30 years of campaigning to get to 7% or 30 days to get to 70%. Which should we focus on?
So that, I mean, that puts us in an interesting spot. You have both experience, both being directly involved with and supporting politics and a political party, and then you also have quite a bit of a business experience, both of your own and consulting and speaking to businesses. So I think you might be the perfect person to ask. You always get a million answers to this question, but I'd love to know yours. Where does the balance between private industry and government come to when you're trying to work out sustainability?
Well, they both have to be involved. It's a push and a pull. Businesses can actually act far faster than government can. And we need a balance of both. And I'll use a story in Toronto. 54% of the carbon footprint in Toronto is due to buildings. You know, we're in buildings 90% of our time. We work in them. Our homes are buildings. So if you want to change the carbon footprint of Toronto, focus on buildings. And for the residential sector, 90% of new homes in Toronto are condos. So the Toronto Atmospheric Fund in Toronto focused on green condos, and they defined a green condo as being 25% more energy efficient than the average Canadian condo. So the developer that they initially worked with, Tridel, didn't want to put $3,000 of upgrades, green upgrades, in the condos because they were worried about the purchase price that first-time home buyers might get a sticker shock with. So, you know, more efficient windows, appliances, low flush devices, shower, faucets, etc. Well, so they went to TAF and said, look, you give us a $500,000 loan, we'll match it with a $500,000 investment of ourselves. That'll be $1 million. We'll put in the green upgrades into every unit of this new development, and we'll sell them at the regular sticker price. So look at this. For the buyer, they get $3,000 of upgrades for free. That's great for first-time buyers who are sustainability sensitive.
Mm-hmm.
And the payment for them came out of the reduced operating ongoing expenses. So they saved on energy, electricity, and gas and everything as a condo owner, but they didn't end up taking all that savings. They left some of it for the homeowner. So look at this. The homeowner gets the same purchase price with $3,000 of upgrades. They get cheaper operating costs, and once the 75% of that savings is paid the loan after 7 years, their operating costs drop even further. So it's a win-win-win. It's a win for the buyer. It's a win for the developer. They sold out like hotcakes, okay? So then their competitors start going to TAF, Toronto Atmospheric Fund, saying, hey, give us a $500,000 loan. They do that. Well, once 51% of all new condos were this green standard, the leading developers went to city council and said, why is your lax standard supporting the laggards who are polluting the planet? Why don't you make this the minimum entry standard? So the leaders used it to kick the laggards where it hurt as a competitive advantage. So city council passed that bylaw, and now every condo in Canada, or in Toronto, sorry, must be 25% more efficient than the Canadian average. So now the green loan program for TAF is 40% more efficient. So this is where you can use private business. You have to break the barriers. You have to get a lead group and tip the market. And once the market is tipped, you can make the whole market.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's one of the things that came up in one of my classes when we were talking about green building was that it was the very thing that you were talking about, which is where the actual person, because there's like a developer and an actual builder and an architect, and there's so many different people involved. It's not like a home where there's a single home buyer and they go and contract somebody to design and then build their home, and there might be a designer, there might be an architect and a builder in construction, all these different things, but it's all coming down to the same person, the client. But that's not really how it works when we're talking about, for instance, condo towers, which where there may be a contractor and a builder and a developer, but they all sort of pass money in between each other before the actual buyer does. So the person who could reap the benefits of, say, the environmental things like a heat exchange system or something like that, the ultimate building owner that then rents to clients, isn't the person that can save money from it. And so a lot of these things, and so it's just a matter of where it's like, in general, in theory, everybody involved in the chain of the process could be interested in this green technology, but because the right money isn't making it to the right hands, everybody at the end of the day just has to look out for their pocketbook. Do you think that this is that one of the major problems? Is it a fact where maybe do we already have people who are on board and they just don't have the tools required to do some of these initiatives?
Well, yes. I mean, it's the classic problem of owners and renters. In Toronto, we have a lot of old apartment buildings. I was just listening to David Miller and Karen Farbridge, the mayor of Guelph, at an event on Thursday night. And in Toronto, we have all these old buildings that are leaking heat.
Actually, Jim, you know what? I'm super sorry. I shouldn't have even gotten into that question. I just realized we've got about 30 seconds left. I'm so sorry.
Well, I'll just finish it quickly. Sure. These buildings could be reskinned or clad, but the owners would have to pay for it when it's the renters who get lower costs of electricity and heat. So you have to break the owner-renter barrier, and we can actually do that and create 30,000 jobs in Toronto and literally save millions of dollars for tenants. So we can actually figure this out.
All right. Well, I wish we had more time to talk to you. I'm afraid we don't, Jim. Thank you so much for joining us.